This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and boy, I've been gone for a long time, so it's great to be back with you. Let's get right down to business. Donald Trump gave a major economic policy address in Detroit this afternoon, something of a reset for the Republican nominee after days of unrelenting controversy last week, though his speech today couldn't fully escape that controversy. Protesters interrupted Trump several times as he spoke at the Detroit Economic Club. Nevertheless, today Trump offered some new details on how he would boost the economy, saying he wants to, quote, jumpstart America. It can be done, and it won't even be that hard.
When we reform our tax, trade, energy, and regulatory policies, we will open a new chapter in American prosperity, which is so desperately needed. We need a new chapter.
So to start today, we're going to focus on two of those issues, taxes and regulation. Donald Trump says slashing taxes and ending regulations can revitalize the American economy as a whole. Well, it turns out we can already see the effects of differing tax policies and regulatory frameworks on prosperity within the 50 different United States themselves. They're an interesting economic laboratory, according to Yale political scientist Jacob Hacker. He's co-author of the new book, American Amnesia: How the War on Government Led Us to Forget What Made America Prosper, and he joins us now from Yale. Professor Hacker, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me, and I guess I should say welcome back.
I've just been sort of dancing on different shows and away for a while, but I'm glad to be back. So let me first ask you, let's just get right down to it. You looked at red states and blue states, you know, to roughly describe them. Are the policies that Donald Trump espoused today about slashing taxes and really reducing regulations, or do states that follow that prescription, are they more prosperous?
Well, the short answer is no. If cut and extract, as we call it, that is cut taxes and cut regulations, especially on extractive industries, was the key to prosperity, the distribution of income and wealth in the United States would be about opposite of what it is across the states. The richest states, the blue states, and they're not just richer in terms of income. They have better health. They have higher levels of education. They have more patenting activity, more research and development, lower rates of poverty, less lack of health insurance, more food security. I mean, you go down the list, it's actually pretty hard to find an indicator that looks better on average in red states than it does in blue states. And so
I just want to jump in here for a point of clarification. When you say red or blue states, how are you specifically defining them?
Yeah, so absolutely. I mean, that is the big question. And what we're really interested in here, since the states are, in a sense, a laboratory of policy, is what the state policies look like. And in an early version of this analysis, we looked at state economic policies, a broad index of state economic policies. But it turns out that correlates almost perfectly with the partisanship of states in recent presidential elections, which is a lot easier for people to understand. And so in the piece, we focused on the states, on the one hand, the blue states that had gone for the Democrat in the last four presidential elections, so since 2000, and on the other hand, the red states, the states that had gone for Republicans in the last four presidential elections, which essentially comprises roughly 40 states. So there are 10 states that, and they're familiar to us, they're the battleground states that fall in between. But I want to be clear that these differences in partisanship correlate very closely with differences in policies within the states.
Okay. Well, so let's just touch back on what Donald Trump said this afternoon for a second here and look at taxes specifically, because today he called for an end to the estate tax. He also called for an exclusion of childcare expenses from taxation, and he called for a 15% cap on all business income tax. Now, this, of course, would all be at the federal level. And he also called for reducing the current number of tax brackets from 7 down to 3. And then he said this.
I am proposing an across-the-board income tax reduction, especially for middle-income Americans. This will lead to millions of new and really good-paying jobs. The rich will pay their fair share, but no one will pay so much that it destroys jobs or undermines our ability as a nation to compete.
And you also mentioned ending the carried interest tax loophole, as he called it. But I'm wondering, when it comes to state level taxation, were the states with supposedly higher income taxes better off than those with lower?
They were not. If you just look across the states, the blue states are richer and they generally have higher taxes on the well-off. You know, you could look at the total tax burden. You can look at the share of taxes paid by the top 1%. And I think the point is not that taxes are irrelevant. It's just that the much more important factors involve whether the states offer a conducive environment for innovation and investment. And the cities where this occurs, cities like San Francisco, New York, Seattle, Boston, are cities that have invested heavily in public education. They're cities that have had a long tradition of receiving federal research and development dollars. They're cities that attract highly skilled, highly educated workers. And so taxes matter, but what you do with those taxes matters probably even more.
Yeah. So this brings up a really interesting or major wrinkle, I would say, because you mentioned Boston. And as you know, the Brookings Institution earlier this year said that Boston, in terms of income inequality, is the most unequal city in the entire United States. So while, you know, all the things that you said about where the city chooses to throw its money and its support are true, it's also led to this other reality, which I think, you know, many people who are on the suffering end of that inequality, you know, they feel a lot of support, or they want to throw their support behind the policies of someone like Donald Trump.
Yeah, and there's huge disparities within states, too, between urban and rural areas, which I think is also a major factor that's driving Trump's support. But we note in the piece that the Achilles heel of this huge amount of wealth creation and innovation that's occurring is high levels of inequality. And it is true that on average, the blue states have higher inequality. It's worth noting that those states also do a lot more to offset inequality. They're more likely to have state-specific earned income tax credits, for example, or to expand Medicaid. So on balance, they may not be places that are more unequal when you consider those benefits. But the point is that the big issue, I think, in these places is that not only are people cash-strapped who are at the lower end of the income spectrum, but they're facing very high housing costs. And I think that's the real issue, housing affordability. It's an issue for our nation because if more and more of our total economic activity is taking place in these dense urban hubs, then we need to figure out how to get more people into them. And that means more high-rise housing. That means fewer restrictions that reduce the degree to which you can construct affordable housing. It means more investment in affordable housing. And we're not arguing in this piece that the blue states have it all figured out. There's a bunch of problems in blue states. I think our main point is that when you hear the politicians, particularly Republicans, saying, look, you know, look at the South, look at these red states, you're really missing the bigger picture. Prosperity is a result over the long term of investment in science and education, not just cutting taxes or pulling stuff out of the ground.
Yeah. So on that point, I mean, Donald Trump has spoken about his running mate's record in Indiana, for example. And you know, we were looking at some numbers during Mike Pence's tenure as governor of Indiana. He did reduce or the government there did reduce the state's income tax rate from 3.4% down to 3.3%. It's going to further drop to roughly 3.25% at the beginning of 2017, and the state also added almost 150,000 jobs between when Pence took office and May 2016. So, you know, there's an example of a red state, at least with those numbers, doing fairly well.
Well, and we, you know, there's exceptions across the board on these things. But what we do know is that the states that have doubled down and pursued the most aggressive tax cutting strategies, states like Kansas and Louisiana, have not had very good outcomes. And it's very hard to compare the short-term trajectory of any state. I mean, so that's why in this piece, Paul Pearson and I really look at the sort of long-term development of all of these measures of prosperity, including health and education as well as income. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I think is most telling is that it used to be that the red states and the South in particular, were converging dramatically with the rest of the nation. And since the 1980s, when we've become a much more knowledge-oriented economy, the opposite has been occurring. There's actually been growing divergence. We point out that, for example, Massachusetts Texas and Utah were very close to Massachusetts in terms of average income by the 1980s, and now they and in the last 25 years they've essentially fallen farther and farther behind.
Yeah.
So this is a really interesting part of the story. We basically we're seeing forces of divergence where we used to see forces for convergence, and we think a lot of it has to do with what a knowledge economy requires, namely education, investment, and innovation, and so on.
Well, so finally, Jacob Hacker, I'm just curious, because I love the example of looking at the laboratories that are the 50 United States, because I think there is a lot to learn from that. But how much can we really draw? What are we drawing the right kinds of lessons vis-a-vis what the states tell us when we apply it to the United States as a whole? Or is the playing field just different when we're considering the entire nation and changes that might be made at the federal level?
I think it is different. And it's really important to understand that as critical as these state policies are, the federal government's policies, from monetary and macroeconomic policies to the specific things that it does to encourage education, are even more important. And that makes it even more striking in some ways that the states are diverging because the federal government's role is so important. And I think the federal government has a different role, that states are going to have to do a lot to attract business and highly skilled workers, whereas the federal government's role has to be to undergirding the basic system through investment in R&D and education and other kinds of prerequisites of prosperity.
Well, Jacob Hacker is a professor of political science at Yale University and co-author of the new book, American Amnesia: How the War on Government Led Us to Forget What Made America Prosper. Professor Hacker, many thanks for speaking with us today.
Thanks so much for having me on, Meghna.
And we'll take a close look at Hillary Clinton's economic plan, which is expected to be released by her a little later this week. But for now, let's take a quick break. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.